and welcome to Sounding Out with Izzy, the podcast where we have conversations with musicians, music producers, publicists, live promoters, zine makers, journalists, and more about their experiences working in the music industry as women, non-binary, and queer people. I'm your host, Isabel Korp, the founder of the queer femme music-based blog and YouTube channel, A Girl's Two Sound Sense. On today's episode, I am joined by Matt Mitchell, poet, author, and the current music editor at Paste Magazine. My first encounter with Matt's work was actually their poetry, which I found through Hanif Abdurraqib, who I would consider to be one of the greatest poets and cultural critics of my lifetime. So anybody blessed by Hanif the Abdurraqib is going to get my attention. Beyond our conversation about music, we delve pretty heavily into the most glaring blind spots when it comes to queer representation in culture, particularly within the Hollywood intersex canon. And additionally, we engage in a pretty heavy discussion about generational trauma and personal grief. So just a light content warning, there are discussions of suicide in this episode. This was a really cool conversation to have, and it's not just because Paste was the type of magazine I would print and plaster all over my walls as a teenager. I mean, yeah, that was part of it, but it also really means a lot when a guest is willing to open up so generously in this way, and that doesn't go unnoticed. And without further ado, let's get right into this episode. In your first collection of poetry, Neon Hollywood Cowboy, There's a piece about listening to Tyler, the Creator's Igor, while getting hot dogs with your friends. And what I really appreciated about like that piece was how much it was centered on feeling safe and at peace with the community that you'd found at home. So I think I have an idea of like what your answer might be to this, but what ultimately led to the decision not to leave? Why stay in Ohio as an adult?
You know, I grew up as most Ohioans do, which is, you know, especially Ohioans who grow up in a small town where you're just like, I can't wait to leave. I can't wait to go to the big city. And for a long time, that felt like a real attainable goal. I think I was a little bit naive about that because when I was 17, I had already made it known. I was like, I want to go to New York. I want to be a struggling writer. I was really into Bob Dylan. Like, I was like, I really wanted to live like a Bob Dylan lifestyle in New York. And so my mom was like, well, if that's your dream, we should take a trip to New York together and just, you know, enjoy it. Cause I had never been to New York. It was always just a pipe dream that I had seen in movies or TV and felt like, yeah, I can do that. And so we went to New York and I fell in love with it. We were only there for 3 or 4 days. And I really thought it was a beautiful place to be. And that was the goal. And then, you know, I went to college and I remained in Ohio for college. And I slowly started to realize as I got older that I really felt at home in Ohio in a way that every time I go out of the state and I go visit someplace else, I'm like, I'm pining for that kind of warmth. And when I was growing up, if you'd have told me that, I would have been like, you're absolutely crazy. Like, because Ohio gets so ridiculed in culture by people who don't live in Ohio and people who do live in Ohio. So I've always lived pretty consistently in a close proximity to people who think Ohio is not a place that's viable to live. It's not a good place. Obviously our government is horrible. So, you know, there's a lot of factors that turn into that. But as I got older, got out of college, which is after that poem was written, I decided that I started to really realize that I have things that I need to, I have bridges that need to be mended here before I could even think about existing elsewhere. And that is, you know, in that poem, it's seeing how much my friends who live here with me care about me and trying to hone in on this very, very intimate and close-knit community that I think when I'm writing, especially poetry, I think I tend to take a negative approach to that. I mean, in my second book, in Vampire Burrito, there's an entire poem about just absolutely hating the town that I'm from. And I think it works in that book for the sake of it's a past story. It's a idea that I don't really believe in much anymore, at least not to that extent. And so, when I was writing the Tyler, the Creator poem, I was feeling a lot more softer about where I come from because I had finally gotten to a place of thinking, well, it's not, I shouldn't be focusing so much on the place or the town, it's the people. And as much as there are people who I don't have good experiences with who come from the town that I grew up in, I also have a lot of love there. My parents live there. It's where all my grandparents, raised my parents. Yeah, there's a lot of roots there. There's a lot of foundations. And I think I got into that like teenage, angsty, very melodramatic, I hate my hometown kind of guys. And then I had to unlearn that. And I think a lot of people have to unlearn that. So it was really just a matter of finally letting myself embrace the truth of it all, which is Ohio's the place that I'm from. It's the place that's made me, and it's the place that I genuinely feel good about staying in for a while. I don't live in my hometown anymore. I live in Columbus, so I'm in a bigger place. But I like being here. I like the seasons. I like the camaraderie that Midwesterners tend to have with each other. And I just all the people that I know and love the most are right here. And as good as an LA or an NYC sounds to me, which granted it sounds great, so does Chicago, I just realized that my building blocks, my root, my rocks, they're all like 30 minutes or an hour away, or they live in this town that I'm in right now, and so I just feel at home and I feel comfortable embracing the people that I, share this state with at this point.
No, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm sure that there's like a lot of people, especially younger, who really need some of those people to stick around.
Yeah, it's almost kind of like a it's like a ritual. Like I think you have everybody everywhere has to go through a bit of a phase where they're like, oh, I would really love to move anywhere but here. And I think it's a necessary rite of passage to go through because I think if you've lived your entire life not despising the place that you called home, then there's something going on because I think it's very necessary. If you can see the faults in the place you come from while also being actively curious about what parts of it are there to love. And, I think now I'm at a place where I can see both and feel good about existing in between both of those things.
Right, yeah. I definitely hear you 'cause like I'm from Acton, Massachusetts, and it's a very, very, very like nondescript suburb. And the only reason why people move there is 'cause of the schooling. And yeah. I mean, like now when I go back, like I definitely have a lot more grace for it. I think like the root of especially as a teen, was the fact that I was just in a nothing burger of a town. Like, I love Massachusetts, but yeah.
Yeah, it's easy. It's really easy to have a stronger kinship towards your hometown once you've left it for a while and then you come back and maybe you're there for a few days. It's so much easier to take in smaller doses. I've learned that, and it's a good place to be in because I couldn't probably handle it in more than like a 7 to 10 day span, but that is a nice little sweet spot of like, okay, I know I can leave and then come back whenever I want. I can be as hands-on or hands-off with this place as I need to be. And it's a real luxury. Not a lot of people have that luxury, but it's good to be able to have the distance when you need it and not have the distance when you need it.
Yeah. And if we could tie like music into that as well, like there's a lot of like online discourse happening now about like the shit you liked when you were 14 is what you're gonna like forever. But is there anything that you listen to like at that point in your life where you look back and you're like, oh, cringe, cringe, cringe. I can't believe I listened to that. Because I have a few.
That's a great question, and it ties in with a kind of like an ideology that I practice, which is I'm not super ashamed of anything that I've ever enjoyed listening to. Maybe Maybe the pop country musicians that I was a fan of when I was like 7 years old, because growing up in rural Ohio, there are more country stations than there are anything else. So I was really subjected to that before my dad kind of swooped in and had his influence of like classic rock. But as a teenager, I went through a couple of phases. I had been staunchly like a rock head for a long time until I was, 12 or 13, and then I'd finally got introduced to the concept of the Billboard Top 40. And well, I guess by then it was firmly just the Hot 100, but and I spent that whole summer, it was like the summer between 7th and 8th grade. I spent that whole summer just riding my bike outside and at my grandma's house and like cranking the radio up on the local like pop station. And so I'm trying to think of what year that was. That was like 2011. So that was like prime, that was when Kesha was getting big and Lady Gaga was like ruling the charts. That was her fame monster era. And then I remember that summer, the song that was ruling the charts was the Eminem and Rihanna duet, Love the Way You Lie. And I was obsessed with that song. It's like every time that song came on, it was like, okay, we're gonna pause everything that we're doing and we're going to just enjoy this for a second for the 3.5 minutes that it runs. I return to those like early 2010s, mid 2010s pop songs more often than one sane person should at my age, being in like my mid 20s, because I just, there's like some sort of just sentimentality about it. Like I was just, at Paste, I have this series where I go back and I rank, on the anniversary year. So last year we did like 1973, 83, 93, and so on, like all the number one hits of those years. And, a couple of days ago I was starting to look at the charts for all the anniversary years for the fours. And so I was looking at 2014, and it was, and the one song that stuck out to me that I was obsessed with when it came out was Timber by Pitbull and Kesha. And I was like, this is still a fantastic song. Like this is still an incredible pop song. And yeah, I don't know. I'm sure that like when my mom was my age and she looked back on the songs of the 80s that she was obsessed with, she probably felt a little bit cringy about it and felt maybe they were a little corny. But now she just, that's her thing. She will only really listen to the song she grew up with. And I think that I've almost expedited that process of my life where I still feel pretty ooey gooey about the songs that were big and popular when I was growing up, when I was, coming of age, basically. And now, obviously, I got away from the mainstream charts when I was 16 and, discovered, I got really into folk music. And so I was like obsessed with Bob Dylan and Peter Paul Mary and Neil Young. And I went through like a punk phase and a grunge phase. Like, when I was 16, my favorite band of the world was Nirvana. Like I went through all these phases, and now I get to reap the rewards, which is I'm 25, going to be 26, and I get to just throw all of these in a pot and just listen to whatever and just have fun. Like I will put on like Dynamite by Tayo Cruz whenever I feel like it, and I'll have a great time because that was a song that was up at the top of the charts when I was 12. It's a song that I can't say for certain that it has aged particularly well, but it's still something that like I'll put it on. I'm not having a bad time. I'll tap my foot to this. It's great. So I don't really feel guilty or like ashamed of any of my past music choices, but I fully understand and respect the people who do, because I'm sure that like as culture changes, as zeitgeist transforms, it just everything is different. And so I always try to keep a level head about that. But no, I'll embrace all the music that I loved 10 years ago. I'm not afraid.
I love that. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely like it's a nice philosophy to have. I just like sometimes I think there can be overcorrections. For example, like one of my really, really good friends, Holly from Razor Braids, I'm always going to plug my friends' bands no matter what.
You have to.
She,
That's a rule. You have to do that.
of course. Yeah. I mean, so she is from Nashville and she still loves Florida Georgia Line, but she genuinely feels guilty about that. But she also acknowledges it, like that shit, and she still like unironically likes listening to it. But yeah.
Yeah, I feel the same way about The one song that I think is like applicable to that is the song Need You Now by, was it Lady Antebellum? They're called Lady
Yeah,
A now. They've
right.
corrected themselves. I just think that that's a beautiful song. It's a well-written song. Of course, it's a pop country song, but I don't know. You put it on, I'm getting emotional about it. But like, you know, it probably also helps that I don't feel particularly ashamed or embarrassed about my love of songs from 10 years ago, because at my heart, in the deepest part of my soul, I'm a Gleek. So I know no I the embarrassment is just not in the vocab for me right now, because I, you know, I love that show, and that show continuously would keep pop songs on rotation. Not all the covers were good, but I like look back at it and I'm like, well, Need You Now, that they covered that on Glee and it was incredible. And so I'm just like, I totally understand about the Florida Georgia Line. I got When Florida Georgia Line got big, I had kind of fallen completely out of the pop country game, and I still feel like I am completely out of it. It's just not my scene. But that seems to be the pretty like consensus choice of songs that people are like, oh, I can't believe I really fucking liked that song when I was 13. It seems to always be a pop country song, I think.
Right. Have you seen The Price of Glee? The docu-series or documentary? I can't remember.
I was gonna watch it, and then I'd heard that it was unauthorized by the victims' families, I believe. Like, I don't think Cory Monteith or Naya Rivera's families like gave it like a stamp of approval, because it was, I don't know, I didn't end up watching it but from what I've heard, and I think you know, from some of the criticisms that I read people's writing about, it felt very much like they were mining really hard for some sort of dramatic like angle to those
Right.
tragedies. And I'm not saying that there shouldn't be a tell-all about Glee, because it seems like a lot of stuff bad went down on that set, whether it's from, you know, death or crimes. You know, it does seem to be something that needs to come out about that eventually. But I think timing-wise, I think it came out pretty quickly after Naya Rivera died, and it felt like they were rushing it, just kind of because Glee was back on Netflix, I believe. And so Glee was back in everybody's main focus when it came to cultural stuff. I think they had re-entered the conversation a bit, but also because Naya had passed away. And so, yeah, it's touchy. I don't know. I don't know if I can't say I'll never watch it, but I remember passing on watching it at the time, because I know that especially Naya's family was not very comfortable with it coming out.
Right. It's not, it's, I get it. It's not an ethically sourced project. Yeah, I
Yeah, and
get it.
it gets thrown under this idea that like the show is cursed, and it's like, no, I mean, that's a different conversation to have than this idea of like this mother died like very tragically, whether there's a curse or not on
Right.
Glee, you know. And I'm not I can't take the road of like there's not something cosmically imbalanced about the Glee cast, but it felt like, as a response to this very significant and very sad thing that had happened, it felt a little sour to me. But maybe one day, if there ever comes like if a like endorsed documentary series or documentary special comes out about Glee, perhaps there's a space where I can watch both to compare and contrast and see what it was about the first one that people weren't cool with, and what is it about the second one that's really doing justice to the story of what went on behind the scenes in this show. So never say never, but as of now, I have not seen it.
Right. Well, I want to talk about Freaks and Geeks for a
I
second.
am happy to at all times.
Because you have written often how you felt a kinship with Jessica Campbell's character, Amy. Do you want to speak a little more about why she resonated with you?
Yeah, it's a long story. I'll try to abridge it if I can. Growing up, my parents
So Freaks and Geeks came out when I was 1 year old. I was a year old. And but when I was like 7 or 8, I don't remember specifically, but I was very young. I was not in double digits yet. My mom started letting me watch it. I don't really know what or why. Maybe it's because I was like really obsessed with classic rock, and that is a very crucial element to the whole show is the soundtrack. And she let me watch it, and there are how many episodes? I believe there are 17 episodes of the show, but there were always two that she wouldn't let me watch. And there was the one that was called Chokin' and Tokin', and that was about, it was kind of a double whammy, that episode, because when I was younger, I was deathly allergic to peanuts. And in that episode, one of the main characters almost dies from a peanut allergy reaction, on top of the other half of the episode, which is about another main character, Lindsay, trying weed for the first time. So in hindsight, I totally understand why my mom was like, we're going to skip this one on the DVD. But then the other one was The Little Things, which is the penultimate episode of the show. And I had never seen it until I was a teenager. And then when I watched it, you know, the plot line, the major plot line of that episode is that Jessica Campbell's character, Amy, is an intersex person. She was born a hermaphrodite, but when she was a baby, her parents and the doctor like talked through it and decided to have surgery and move forward with her living biologically as a female. And I guess when I was younger, I didn't really I didn't comprehend why that was a difficult episode to show your child. I guess maybe it was conversations that are a little gray area that you just don't want to explore. And, you know, I never really asked. But then when I was a teenager, I through a fluke accident, not accident, but like a fluke happenstance, you know, I had to get genetic testing done, and that requires blood tests and, you know, for a neurological disorder. And I had gone through the testing, and we got a call back from the neurologist, and they were like, well, to figure out what, because I was getting tested for Charcot-Marie-Tooth, which is this neurological disorder that affects your feet and your hands. And in order to figure out which of the 48 types of it you have to have a blood test, and they have to do like a chromosomal test with that. And they did it, and they were like, well, we can't find, Matt doesn't have a Y chromosome, which is the, you know, the chromosome that you, if you're biologically a man, you're supposed to have. So I have 46 XX chromosomes, and I didn't know what that meant for a long time. I'd found that out when I was 15, and it wasn't until I was 20 that I started seeing an adult endocrinologist, and he laid it out for me exactly how it should have been laid out for me 5 years prior, which was you know, you're an intersex person. And, you know, it didn't quite make sense to me because I'm not the classically portrayed case of being intersex, which on TV and in movies, it's, you know, you're a hermaphrodite. That's what intersex identity is boiled down to, basically. It's so much more complex than that. And it's even harder to kind of grapple with when you don't have those like very obvious physical abnormalities or anything like that. And then you know, I'd gone back. I think Freaks and Geeks came out on streaming. I can't remember which platform it was. It might have been Netflix, but I really think it was Hulu. And I revisited it for the first time in a few years. And this is coming from a person who's, I've watched the show over and over again, probably 50 times all the way through. I was just obsessed with it when I was a kid. It was the only thing I ever wanted to watch. And I finally rewatched The Little Things with a different understanding of what I was going through. And I just immediately resonated with that episode so much. And I know that my parents, when they wouldn't let me watch it, didn't know what was wrong with me. No one knew what was wrong with me. I think it was other forces. You know, my mom, I've asked my mom since then, she doesn't really remember. So we'll never know for sure. But I'd resonated so hard with that character because it takes so much fearlessness to admit that to somebody. And I had gone through that more than once in my life. And the way that Seth Rogen's character, who plays her boyfriend in the show, Ken, ends up, you know, he at first he's very confused about it. You know, he goes through this whole internal
monologue with himself of like whether or not he's gay, and even though like he's dating a woman, and you know, he tells his friends, and his friends are like really fucking weirded out by it, and they're like, you should break up with her. And he's like, and there's just a lot of scenes in that episode where the resolution is that Ken is like, I don't care, I just want to be with you. And to me, it was such a refreshing portrayal of someone being intersex on a TV show, because the only frame of reference I'd had prior to that was the episode of Friends, which I've written about in the past a few times, where the entire point of the episode is making countless hermaphrodite jokes. And you know, it felt so, like such an othering moment
Right,
to
and then the
revisit.
creator, like later went on to be like, well, maybe I wouldn't have written that out of the into the
Exactly.
episode. And you're like, what do you mean, maybe? Just
Yep, yeah.
don't do it.
Exactly. And it's that's frustrating, because when I was in high school, I was obsessed with Friends. Like we didn't have streaming services until I was, you know, like a senior in high school by that point. And so I did the thing where I'd save up my allowance and I'd buy the seasons on DVD, each individual one. They would sell them in like 2 packs at Walmart for $20. And so I'd save up my allowance and buy each 2 pack as I could. And so I just devoured that show. And then obviously when I watched it the first time through, I had no idea that it would impact me so much, but it always felt a little bit weird, because it's always, we live in a time now where I think television is becoming a little bit more conscious of, hey, maybe it's not the best choice to dedicate an entire episode to making fun of them, like a marginalized group of people, which thank goodness, but TV's still not perfect. But it felt, after making that discovery and having my doctor finally just like shoot it straight with me and be like, this is who you are, and I don't know why people weren't telling you this prior to me doing it, you look back and you think about like, well, who can I relate to on the screen? And there's almost nobody, you know? And so many people have roles that they can look to, you know, even trans people at this point. There are some very empathetic and very beautifully written and portrayed circumstances of trans people on the screen that you can look at and you'd be like, this is a step forward, this is a very good portrayal. But when it comes to intersex people, there just was none except for Jessica Campbell's. And as great as Jessica Campbell is in that show, I have to give like so many thanks to the writers, which is Judd Apatow and Paul Feig, who just, they didn't take the route of, we can make this a very venomous story that ends in them breaking up, because Ken cannot, you know, imagine a world where he's dating somebody who was born with both sets of human genitalia. They didn't take that route. And as a 20-year-old who just wanted something to latch on to, I can't even begin to like fully and properly articulate how monumental that can be for somebody. And it was monumental for me, and that's about as best I can do at like at explaining how important it was.
Yeah. I remember The Little Things being my favorite episode personally. Like when I watched it like decades ago, it was largely because of her.
Yeah, because she's on, what is she in? Is she in Election? Is that her movie that she's in?
I think
I can't
so.
remember. I believe she's in Election. And, you know, Jessica Campbell was not an intersex person in real life, but I'm not in the frame of mind where I'm like, they could have had an intersex person play her. No, it was 1999. I'm not really, you know, hung up on the representation of it all on like a very atomic level like that. I think what I will say is I miss that show dearly. And as much as I'm sad that it got canceled and we never got the opportunity to see that relationship go any further, it's so crucial to who I am as a person and how I walk about the world, knowing, you know, that a show like that was willing to make their penultimate episode such a heavy topic like that, and opt to just bring it such a compassionate finale with it. And you know, I not many shows of that era would have done it. Most shows did not do it. And so I don't know, Sometimes when I talk about my poetry or my writing, I get asked the same questions, and I step back from them, and I'm like, ugh, I wish that we could ask like a different question. But across the board, Freaks and Geeks is like the one thing that I will talk about anytime someone wants to listen, if only to spread the good word about the show so more people go and watch it, because I think that's the kind of show that everybody should watch at least once before they die, because it's just such a perfect nugget of a season of 17, 18 episodes of TV.
I concur. So, music and pop culture are obviously like very intertwined with your work, and I understand that like at this point they kind of have to be since it's like part of your profession as an editor now. But is there any specific artist in your life who's influenced the way you approach your daily life, like be it in personal relationships or the way you might react to certain situations, like where you're like, this person taught me this and left an indelible mark on my life because of that.
I mean, I think the obvious answer, the answer that comes to me immediately, I would assume is the correct answer because it's the first one that came to mind. It would be Neil Young. I write about Neil Young all the time. He is probably my favorite artist to ever walk the earth. He taught me a lot about how to write about grief in a space that is normally performative, but make it entirely personal, because he did his work in music and mine in poetry, and there are links between music and poetry, but they're very different art forms. But the shared co like correlation between the two of them is that they're performance mediums. And I mean, poetry doesn't always have to be a performance medium, and I guess music doesn't either, but like a lot of poetry is based on performing it and reading it aloud, and then music, you're going and gigging and doing shows. And when there's a tour that he went on with like a makeshift backing band that was just basically an amalgam of a bunch of backing musicians that he had been working with for the past 5 years. And they went on this very haphazard, very sloppy tour across the US and then over in Europe for a little while in 1973. And this was right after two of Neil Young's closest friends, one of them being a bandmate, one of them being a roadie, both died from drug overdoses. And he would end up making a record called Tonight's the Night, which is completely about both of them dying. And it taught me a lot on about how to explore grief in a way that isn't maybe how other people would want you to explore grief, but it's the way you need to explore grief for yourself. And I think, I come from a family that is pretty shadowed by tragedy. I mean, my dad's brother committed suicide in 1985, and that's an event that has really impacted the very DNA of our family for the last 40 years. And it was very helpful to have that record in my back pocket as sort of a means of how do we remember somebody that was close to us? How do we remember somebody who, for years and years after this record is put out, these people aren't going to know who that is. They're going to have never met him. How do we speak of people who are dead in ways that make it so very clear that there was some importance to them when they were alive? And I think that the way that Neil Young wrote about his friends after they passed on, which he continued to do, he continued to write about them for years and years after 1972, when they both passed away. And I just, it's taught me a lot because, I always want to write about other people in the most compassionate and affectionate way possible, no matter if their stories are already over. And maybe it wasn't the most, it maybe it was a pretty tragic ending to their story. I want to write about them just as affectionately as I would if they were still living and they were still close to me. And yeah, I think Neil's a way that he can articulate the world around him is so breathtaking in that sense, where I didn't know Bruce Barry and I didn't know Danny Whitten. They lived and died 20 plus years before I came onto the earth. But you know, when I listen to those songs, I feel like I knew them. And that's whenever I write something, be it a poem, be it an essay or whatever, that's the takeaway that I want people to have with my work, is that maybe they didn't know my uncle, maybe they don't know these people that are in my immediate life. But I want them to leave the book, leave the essay, feeling like they have a pretty good sense of who they are, to the point of like if they had met them, they could strike up a conversation with those people easily.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I'm sorry to hear about your uncle. That's tough.
It's okay. I could say that it's easier for me because I didn't know him. But that would kind of be a lie, because I think it's harder because I didn't know him, because there's this just gap, and it's like you're trying to figure out, well, why is my dad in such pain? Why were my grandparents in such pain for the entirety that they were alive while I was alive? You know, and so there are more questions than there are answers, and so it's hard, but at the same time, there are other people in my life right now who are affected by that as well. And it's just as hard for them in different ways. So it's, you know, it's, I used to be like, oh, don't worry about it, it's fine. I never knew him, I'm not affected by it. Only recently, in a few last few years, I've started to come around to being open about it and saying, no, it is hard because it's affected my family. And my family is my family, and I'm with them all the time. And you can see how these absences are so immense, and they're so hard to overcome. And so yeah, it takes a long time to accept grief for what it is, instead of trying to just downplay it because of your proximity to those things. So I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense because it's the same with my grandfather on my mom's side. I never knew him. He died when I was an infant. And from what I hear about him, like I really want to give him more grace, but doesn't sound like he was the best father or husband. So it always feels like more difficult when it's just like, okay, well, like what could have been if I had gotten to have a conversation with this person?
And it's hard to, you know, what you're talking about with learning things about a family member who's passed on after they've died, learning things that maybe are not the most flattering things about them. You know, I had a similar situation with my grandfather after he passed away, where, you know, when he was alive, I was like just the apple of his eye. I was his only grandchild. And, you know, the way that him and I would interact, you'd never believe that he'd ever done anything bad in his life. But then, you know, he passes on and you hear these fragments of things that he did that weren't as good, you know, and you're tasked with whether or not you allow those to cloud the perception of who this man was to you. And I don't know if it's easier or harder to hear those things if you know, if they pass away before you're born, or if, when you're an infant. But it's definitely, family is one of those weird ongoing archival projects where you're always just learning things, and you never really know if they're good or bad, but you can't un not learn them. They just hit you, and you're basically tasked with, well, how do I wake up tomorrow feeling about this person now that I know this? And it could be challenging, it could be complex, and it can be full of a lot of grief that when you're born, you don't realize that you're signed up for all of this grief, you know. And but it's just, it comes, and it can be a lot sometimes.
Yeah, especially when it's grief for an unremembered person.
You never think that you can grieve somebody you never knew, but you certainly can. I've learned it firsthand, and I'm sure you've learned it firsthand,
Yeah.
that it's quite possible to feel a lot of things for people who never even had the chance to feel things for you back. So it's heavy sometimes.
Yeah. On a slightly lighter note, because I can't help it. I cannot resist. What was it like getting on a call with the Polly Jean Harvey?
Polly Jean is a sweetheart. You know, I've interviewed a lot of people in a short amount of time. And so normally I'll get on a call and I'm unfazed at this point because it's just muscle memory. You know, when I started out freelancing and interviewing people for the first time, I used to get so nervous over before interviews and to the point where I'm just like, oh, I want to dry heave because it's so nervous. Like I'm so nervous and so anxious about this. You practice and you practice and you do a bunch of them and you're like, okay, I can handle this now. It's no sweat. Interviewing PJ Harvey was the most nervous I've been for an interview in over a year. I've gotten the chance to talk to some incredible people in my lifetime so far. But PJ Harvey she's one of the few musicians that are alive right now that I consider to be like walking, living legends who still have so much relevance right now. You know, like people like the Rolling Stones, like Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, they're legends and they're living legends. But you can't, it's harder to decipher how much relevance they still carry in 2020 through 2024 now. You know, they still make good music, but PJ Harvey just put out one of the best records of her career, and she's been doing this for 30 years plus. And you think about, you find out you get that interview, and your immediate like emotions are like, oh my fucking God, I cannot believe that I'm going to interview this person who rarely ever does interviews. Like, this is incredible. And then it sits with you for a second. And you're like, what the fuck am I going to talk to her about? She's been asked so many questions under the sun. I don't want to regurgitate stuff that she's already heard and answered. And that's kind of the territory that comes whenever you interview a musician who's been doing it for 20 plus years. I ran into the same issue a couple months back when I interviewed, Sleater-Kinney, because you're like, oh, they've been doing this since like the mid 90s. They probably have been asked everything. What can I bring to them that will not bore them on our call? But luckily, Polly Jean is just a lovely, lovely, beautiful person. And she, from the jump in our interview to the end of it, just took every one of my questions and was just so gracious about answering them. I can't tell you whether or not she's answered them before. She likely probably has in some regard or another. But she treated me like I was the first person to ever interview her. And I imagine that that's how she goes into conversations a lot. And it meant so much because I had gone in so nervous. I was like, oh my God, I don't want to blow this in front of like one of the most important musicians of my lifetime, And it went so well that I don't rank interviews. It's not my thing because everybody I talk to brings something to the table that I find fascinating, and the fact that they were willing to give me a little bit of their time to talk about their art is just such a gift. So I don't really ever th someone like I'll go home for the holidays and my aunt will come over and she'll be like, who's your favorite interview you've done? And I'm like, I don't have one. I like them all. Like they're all wonderful people. And I get so many different things from each person. But I do feel confident saying that, interviewing Polly Jean is one of the one of my favorite and one of the best interviews I've ever done, just because she's just so gravitationally kind and really makes you feel like, it's just you and her in a room chatting about art, chatting about poetry, about music, and she really makes you feel like you're doing a great job, and she's really receptive to the questions, and she's one of a kind. That's what I can say for sure.
Not surprised. Yeah.
I was a little, she's had some trouble over the years with interviewers, especially men who interview her and ask the worst questions possible, and some that are like asked in this tone that are kind of a little bit sexist, a little bit misogynistic, very like they look down upon her, because she's a woman making music. And that kind of history that someone has with interviewers can sour the future that you and who you go into a conversation with. But she was so wonderful, and I'm just so glad that she was so generous with her time and wanted to talk to me for like 40 minutes on a Tuesday morning.
Well, yeah, and in this case, I think like it's clear that she could sense the warmth and like the reverence on your end. So I think she appreciated that, I'm sure.
That's what I could, that's all I can hope for with every conversation I go into with a musician. I don't even like phrasing them as interviews because I just the cookie cutter Q&A kind of stuff that a lot of journalists do, it's just not for me. I want to have like personal conversations with these people because I mean all of our art that we make, whether it's singing or performing or writing poetry or writing an essay, you know, it's coming from, you know, a place deep inside us, and that's the place I want to be when I'm having these conversations with people. I don't want to be on the surface just being like, what songs are inspiring you to make this album, blah blah blah. I just, you know, I want to get to the root of it, to the psyche of these musicians and how they tick. I want to know what, you know, what's driving them beyond what you might hear in the music itself.
So like moving on, like in the past few, like past 3 years maybe, and I know this is a topic that you'll feel really strongly about, there's been, I guess, like somewhat of a whole thing, like I guess of being hateful to the Beatles on the internet renaissance.
Oh yes, it's a terrible trend.
But it does seem to be like dying down. But I mean, and like I get the criticism. They did play like a large part in like the Europeanization of like rock and roll, which is like largely like a started out as a black genre coming from the blues and stuff like that. So I understand like where like no one's above criticism, but like I don't know. And maybe like people being like, "Oh, well, if this is what I'm told to like all my life, I'm just gonna go against the grain and be like, well, fuck you. I think this is mid." So like I get it. I get it.
Yeah.
But not saying I agree though.
The Beatles are interesting. I mean, when I was growing up, you know, my first CD I ever got was a Beatles CD. And I have always deeply, deeply loved the Beatles, especially Paul McCartney. Even in, I think in adulthood, I care more about Paul's solo work than I do the Beatles catalog. But I see these arguments, and I know that most of them are made for the sake of clicks, for the sake of traffic. You know, this idea that, oh, the Beatles suck. Well, I don't think that anybody has to admit that the Beatles are good. I think that the Beatles are just canonically great for the rest of time. And no one person on Twitter saying they're kind of mid is ever going to change that legacy. My issue with the whole conversation really revolves around people wanting to take a stance for the sake of being contrarian rather than just taking the easy route, which is the Beatles aren't for me, but I can understand why they are so important to the fabric of modern music and how they've been so crucial to music for the last 50 plus years. You can look at so many different avenues of different artists, and you can trace it all the way back to the mid-60s when they were really starting to experiment with techniques that are still being used. And I'm with you too on the criticisms part because I feel the same way about you know Elvis, but on a different scale. I mean, Elvis was very much directly ripping off black artists, like to the point where it's insane how like how much his career was built off the backs of black musicians. And then, you know, the Beatles were trying to rip off Elvis and rip off Buddy Holly. So it's this kind of chain reaction of people ripping off each other when you boil it down to it, it's just a very distanced at this point cheapening of black art. But what I will say is the Beatles did it in such a way that is interesting to look at because that's how the beginning of their career was started, was that they were covering Little Richard, they were covering Chuck Berry, they were covering all of these pioneers of rock and roll, putting their own spin on it. Doing like the Europeanization of rock and roll with the British invasion. And then they just ditched it completely and were like, actually, let's do some really out there shit that nobody's doing. So it's a very interesting like dichotomy in their own career to look at. And I think it's a fascinating one that warrants criticisms and
warrants praise as well, because they're so immovable. They're such an immovable force at this point in music history that whenever I see someone on Twitter just like shit talking the Beatles, I just scroll past, because it's just every single great musician in the history of modern music has received feedback in that way. And these people don't understand that when you're like tweeting that the Beatles are shit in 2024, that says something about the Beatles' legacy, that you're still thinking about them literally 60 years after they made their American debut on television. So, it's just constantly a cycle going in a circle of like, this band sucks. Well, yeah, you're still thinking about them though, so they had to have been good at some point. And then it's like, well, they've made their impression. We can't undo that impression, and that impression is pretty significant, so we might as well just do the bare minimum of acknowledging that impression and just moving on and going and listening to like the, whatever music we're into, whether it's like death metal or hyper pop or something that, is so detached from what the Beatles even are.
Right, yeah. And back to like the idea of it being immovable. Like Paul McCartney was always gonna like strike out on his own, like with or without the Beatles. Like that's just a fact at this point. Yeah. Okay, so last question. I wanted to wrap up by asking what three of your reference tracks for 2023 are.
So I was thinking about what my favorite songs of the year were, and they all kind of went in the same direction immediately, which is what is like a lot of like pop rock. And so I wanted to bring like three songs that are kind of different that I loved equally. So my three songs are Don't Fade Out by Cutworms. And then also I've got Dedicated to Tar Feather by McKinley Dixon and Alibi by Hooray for the Riff Raff. Very different, three pretty different songs. You've got like indie country, pop rock, and then jazz rap. And so I kind of wanted to take a different approach with it and give three songs that don't sound exactly like alike. And because I was like looking at them, like, okay, Cutworms, maybe the Lemon Twigs, Diners, like I'm just like, all these bands are in the same orbit. We should switch this up a little bit and give it a little bit of diversity in the sound.
Yeah, that's a good mix. Well, Matt, thank you so much for hopping on and for the company. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and thank you for the thoughtful questions. They mean so much.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for listening to Sounding Out with Izzy, and thank you again to Matt Mitchell for joining me for today's episode. This show is brought to you by A Girls to Sound Sense HQ and executive produced by Izzy Corp. That's me! Remember to subscribe and sign up for the mailing list on my YouTube channel and written blog, both under the name A Girls to Sound Sense. Give the podcast a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening, and I will catch you in the next episode of Sounding Out with Izzy.